Hello and welcome back to Otoscope. My name is Eliano and this month Sol and I are bringing science to your ears. We met online with Dr. Oliver House to talk about his research on schizophrenia, mental health, and the psychology behind conspiracy theories. First of all, thank you for accepting our invite and taking some time to actually talk to us about your research. But before we get to the science, we were just interested in if you could tell us about a little bit about your career and how you ended up managing two research teams and also having this clinical work and all of this stuff at the same time.
Yeah, of course, be delighted to. So like a lot of people, I guess, I was always fascinated by the mind. It's what makes us who we are. So as an undergraduate, I studied experimental psychology and got really interested in the science behind our minds and mental processes. And then I went on to study medicine at Oxford. And whilst at Oxford, I got involved in some research in psychiatry, as well as in some other areas like wound healing, but particularly enjoyed that research in psychiatry. And so I guess that started my career that led into psychiatric research as it is. But actually, at Oxford, it nearly ended as well, because whilst I enjoyed the research in psychiatry, my experience of psychiatry in medical school was not that great. And that was for three reasons, I think. One was that psychiatry attachment that I had as a medical student was too short. So I didn't really get to see what psychiatry was like, and I didn't get to see patients getting better. And then another reason was that, as is often seems to be the case, psychiatric hospitals and patients are tucked away. And in Oxford, the hospital is separate from the main hospital. It's a couple of miles away, and there is this distance. But probably the most important reason that nearly put me off going into it was that other doctors and nurses really stigmatized psychiatry. So
yeah.
After finishing medical school, I was a bit undecided as to whether I would go into psychiatry or another area of medicine.
So what changed your mind in the end?
Well, what happened was I went, after qualifying as a doctor, I went to do my basic medical and surgical jobs in a hospital. And during that time, I was interested in lots of areas in medicine, but I thought I should give psychiatry a go. But I thought I'd go to London for a year and try it out. Mm-hmm. And I chose the Maudsley Hospital because it's one of the leading psychiatric research centers in the world. And I thought I would go and experience psychiatry for a year and then probably leave London and maybe go back to Oxford, where there's also very good research and psychiatry, and carry on there. But as you can tell, I've never managed to leave London. And I obviously enjoyed it.
Do you think this sort of disconnect that you noticed between the sort of the psychiatry research and the clinical patient interactions that was going on in the main part of the hospital, do you think that there's a sort of reason why these centers for research, sort of the psychiatric research is going on sort of behind the scenes and less interaction with the patients? Is this because there's a general view that psychiatry is a sort of up and coming and still quite a messy science in that way, quite loose, if you catch my drift?
I think the big problem really actually is that there is still a lot of stigma around mental illnesses, and that also rubs off onto psychiatry and psychiatrists. So that meant that as students, sometimes we get a bad idea about these things, and that maybe some of the doctors and nurses that we come across aren't as well informed about psychiatry. They haven't kept abreast with the research and the neuroscience. Things have changed an awful lot in the last 10 or 20 years.
There's been sort of a change for the better, I'd say. And sort of in the recent past, there's been sort of largely general misconceptions surrounding mental illnesses. And you know, as you're right, sort of a bit of a grey area. So why is it, do you think, that psychiatric illnesses are sort of understudied? Do you think that it's largely to do with its revolvement around the brain and the misconceptions and confusion about the brain as an organ and its difficulty to study.
So I think that a big reason why we've had problems with developing new treatments for psychiatry and understanding about psychiatry is that it hasn't had the investment that other areas of medicine have had. And we know that, that say, cancer or heart disease gets twice as much research funding as mental illness. So, you know, that has lots of knock-on effects. Firstly, it means the rate of progress is much slower. You don't have as much money going into it. You don't have as much research. Then because of that, there's less excitement being generated about it. And that's also translated into industry, in some cases, leaving psychiatric research. And that, of course, means that you lose the chance for innovation from industry as well. But I think there are signs that that's changing and that people are beginning to realize that we need to invest in research in mental health if we're going to change things, you know, radically.
Yeah, one of the questions that we have is kind of related to this, because I guess one of the reasons why it is also potentially difficult to study is because maybe it isn't as easy to model as other diseases, because psychiatric diseases are often diagnosed based on clinical interview rather than, let's say, a specific biomarker or imaging sign. So how do you model these diseases, and how do you find these signs or these biomarkers to complement the diagnosis of this disease?
Yes, so modeling symptoms, of course, is a challenge for any disorder, because symptoms are the human interpretation of what's going on because of the disease. But it's particularly the case for illnesses like schizophrenia, where you're talking about complex problems that are related to what it means to be a human. And you know, schizophrenia, typical symptoms of schizophrenia are experiences like hallucinations and delusions. And, you know, a hallucination is the experience of hearing a voice when there's no one around. People often think it's a voice inside your head, but it's not. That's not the case. It's a voice that sounds like it's in the room with you. And of course, it's a voice that quite often they are very critical, making lots of negative comments. Sometimes they talk about your thoughts or your innermost secrets and discuss what you're doing. Sometimes there are multiple voices. So you can imagine how distressing and troubling that is, how it affects your ability to get on with life. And delusions, you know, these are experiences like becoming preoccupied with a thought or belief out of proportion to reality, something that takes over your thinking and behavior. So it might be, for example, I might become convinced that the MI5 had implanted a microchip into my brain, and this was beaming my thoughts to other people in the room or back to the MI5 who were also spying on me. This takes over your whole life. And so you can imagine, of course, these are complicated phenomena that you can't readily capture in a mouse or a rat. You can't ask it if it's hearing voices or if it believes it's being spied on. So what we have to do is we have to look in different ways. And the approach that we've taken in my group has been to focus on the biology. So what we do is we do studies in patients and then we back translate them into models. So for example, we've looked at the biology underlying delusions, and that has identified that a chemical messenger called dopamine plays a critical role in the development of delusions. And we're then able to look at the changes in the dopamine system that underlie delusions in people with schizophrenia, and then model that in animal models and then look at the neural basis of that, what's going on at the nerve level, to understand better what could be going on in patients, and then take that back into patients and hopefully develop better treatments for patients as a result.
So your research is principally revolving around the dopamine hypothesis, and you're investigating its mechanisms in schizophrenia specifically?
Yes, that's been a major line of our research for the last 10 years or so. And there's been lots of evidence for a long time that dopamine must be involved in schizophrenia. But what we hadn't been able to test is what was actually going on in patients until the last decade or so, when we were able to use brain scanning techniques to measure the synthesis of dopamine. And other people have also looked at the release of dopamine in the brains of patients with schizophrenia and look at how that relates to the development of symptoms. And we started a series of studies about 10 years ago that looked at people who hadn't developed schizophrenia, but who were at high risk of developing the illness. And we measured their dopamine system and then followed them up and measured their dopamine system as they developed schizophrenia. And what we found was that there was increased synthesis of dopamine before they developed the illness, and this increased and underlies the development of symptoms, particularly these delusions that are central to the disorder. So this is really key in highlighting that this central role of dopamine in the development of the illness, and a particular part of the dopamine system, showing that the synthesis and release of the dopamine in a particular brain regions is critical to the development of the illness.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, because dopamine is a kind of a neurotransmitter, so potentially has lots of effects. So what specifically about dopamine affects these patients? And I mean, of course, I assume that there will be some parts of the brain that are more affected than others. Could you just explain a little bit what dopamine is in general and how you can find out how these patients specifically suffer from a dysfunction in this neurotransmitter?
Yeah, so as you say, it's a neurotransmitter. It's a chemical messenger that's released by some nerve cells in our brains. Actually, what's fascinating about dopamine is that there's a very small number of nerve cells that release dopamine in our brains, you know, only a few hundred thousand. And given that our brains have about 80 billion nerve cells in them, a few hundred thousand is an absolute drop in the ocean.
It's relatively small.
It's really, you know, a very small proportion. And yet this chemical messenger has such far-reaching effects, because it's able to alter someone's thinking and behavior and cause delusions and this complicated disorder called schizophrenia. And the reason that dopamine can have this effect is because the nerve cells that release dopamine do so in some critical brain regions. And the one that's key for schizophrenia is the brain region called the striatum, which is deep in the brain. And it's in a relay station. So it's a major relay station where lots of nerve cells from all over the brain send fibers and then interact with other nerve cells, and messages get sent to and from all sorts of brain regions. And dopamine, because the dopamine nerve cells act there to then modulate the traffic of information, and because of the connections of this part of the brain, they're able to have far-reaching effects. And that's I think why a change in dopamine can have these sorts of effects. What's going on, we think, in people who are developing schizophrenia and delusions is that the dopamine system is overactive. Too much dopamine is being made and then released, and it's being released at the wrong time. Because what dopamine does in this part of the brain, its role is like a teaching signal. It tells the brain to concentrate on and focus on certain bits of information. It boosts the flow of information through some of these circuits. And of course, that's really important for learning, because, you know, what you need to do to adapt to your environment is you need to pick up what's important and focus on that and ignore irrelevant things. And dopamine helps the brain do that. So it's this learning teaching signal. But when it goes wrong, of course, it's saying all the time, something important is happening, something's going on, you need to find out what it is. And that, I think, is what leads to the delusion, because the brain is being told to make associations with information that shouldn't be connected, that's irrelevant. So patients talk to me and they say that when they're developing at the beginning of the illness, they often tell me they have this very strong sense that something unusual is happening, something really important is happening, other people must know about it, but they don't quite know what it is. And then as this goes on and the delusion emerges fully, they put their finger on it and they come up with an explanation. So actually the delusion is an explanation, I think, for this dopamine dysfunction, which is telling the brain, pay attention, something important's happening, you know, look out.
Yeah.
And then the patient comes up with an explanation, and then dopamine is saying, yes, this is right, you know, this is right. And that becomes hardwired then in their thinking.
Yeah. So dopamine is important for delusions. But I mean, schizophrenia is a complex disease, which is not only about delusions, but it is also about some more negative symptoms, right? Let's say kind of related to depression. And depression itself is often associated with some kind of dopamine dysfunction. So could you tell us a little bit about this overlap among psychiatric diseases? And what is specific to a disease and what is specific to a symptom, let's say?
Yes, I mean, you highlight a really important thing there, that actually some of these symptoms are seen across several different disorders. So delusions are seen in schizophrenia, and they're classic for schizophrenia, but they're also seen sometimes in severe depression. They're also seen in bipolar disorder, which is sometimes called manic depression. And that's been another line of our research, to try and understand why there are some symptoms seen across different disorders. And actually, what we did is we looked at the dopamine system across these different disorders and found that people that had delusions and other psychotic symptoms across disorders showed the same dopamine dysregulation. So it seems that actually the biology is linked much more closely to symptoms than it is to the psychiatric diagnoses. Because, of course, the diagnoses were developed based on doctors observing patients before we had any of the science or understanding as to the biology. So my belief actually is that in a few years' time, we're going to have a revolution in the way we think about psychiatric diagnoses, and we'll start looking at them in terms of the biology, rather than in terms of what the textbooks tell us at the moment. And we'll be talking about, you know, dopamine hyperactivity disorder. That'll be delusions. And we'll be talking about other disorders linked to the biology.
Yeah, and I guess this goes back to the point about biomarkers or signs. I mean, is there any promising advances in terms of finding new biomarkers for this specific disease, or let's say to this specific symptom in this case?
Yes, so we've been developing the brain scanning techniques that we've been using to look at dopamine as a biomarker for identifying people that might be at risk of developing psychosis, but also, I think, probably more usefully for clinical practice, actually looking at treatment response. Because I've been talking very much about dopamine so far, but actually this doesn't explain all of delusions. And there's a group of patients where we find that dopamine isn't dysregulated, and actually another neurotransmitter, another chemical messenger called glutamate, appears to be much more involved. And what we found is that these patients that show the glutamate changes and not the dopamine changes tend to be the patients that do really poorly on our current treatments. And our current treatments all work by blocking dopamine. So that's no surprise, really. So what we're doing now is seeing whether we can use these scanning techniques to develop a way of fingerprinting which patient is which. And then hopefully that would help us choose the best treatment for that individual and get them the best treatment that we can that will really address the biology that underlies their problem.
Okay, so you'll be focusing in the future more on the pathology of the disease and the actual brain biochemistry and physiology. Actually, just to link in to this, there is also evidence that there is a sort of alternate hypothesis for schizophrenia and how it arises through synaptic pruning. Could you tell us a bit about the synaptic pruning hypothesis and maybe how that links with the dopamine hypothesis, whether or not there's a possibility of this leading towards a unified theory of schizophrenia on other mental illnesses?
Yes. So, as you mentioned earlier, the delusions and hallucinations aren't the only symptoms in schizophrenia. You also see these symptoms called negative symptoms, which are things like loss of motivation and blunting of emotional responses. And so this means that people become very isolated. They're unable to carry on with their jobs. They lose social contact, lose friends and family. And that, of course, often occurs as well as delusions and hallucinations. So it's very disabling. And another problem that patients often have are problems with memory and planning. So these sort of higher brain functions. So the synaptic hypothesis is the hypothesis that there is a loss or dysfunction in the connections between nerve cells throughout the brain in people with schizophrenia. And we think in particular that this explains or underlies these negative and cognitive symptoms of the illness. These things like the loss of motivation and memory problems and planning. And actually, I think, as you mentioned, this hypothesis and the dopamine hypothesis could actually be linked, because the changes in the loss of synapses occurs in certain brain regions like the frontal cortex, the front of the brain. And this part of the brain sends nerve fibers down to the striatum, where it is involved in regulating the striatum or controlling the striatum. So if you get loss of the connections in the frontal cortex, then actually this could affect the control of the striatum and the dopamine neurons also that lead up to the striatum to lead to that overactivity in the dopamine system. So I think probably what's going on is that the synaptic problem is the first problem, and that then leads to the dopamine overactivity in the striatum as a secondary consequence.
Right. Do you see that throughout patients in the early stages of developing schizophrenia?
Well, that's a really good question. So whilst we know a lot about the dopamine system in schizophrenia through the scanning studies that I mentioned and some of our animal modeling studies, a lot less is known about what's going on at synapses in patients. And whilst there have been studies from samples taken from the brains of patients who've died, it's only very recently that we've been able to look at synapses in living patients. And that's the only way, of course, that you can tell what might be going on early in the disease. So the study that we published last year was the first to show that a marker of these synapses, these brain connections, is lower in patients earlier in the course of the illness. So that's the first evidence that it might really be the first thing that happens. But we need to test that further. And that's something we're doing now and trying to study patients really right at the beginning of the illness.
Yeah, I guess loss of synapses, for me, it sounds like, I mean, the brain is not functioning as well in some parts. And to me, this almost leads me to the question, maybe it has nothing to do, but how is this linked to dementia in some way? Is this a certain kind of neurodegeneration in some parts of the brain? I mean, for example, Parkinson's disease is also associated with dopamine dysfunction. So do you think that this synaptic loss or loss of connectivity can have broader effects than just schizophrenia?
Well, you hit something there, actually, that's very interesting, because before the illness was called schizophrenia, it was called dementia precox, which is a Latinized version of early onset dementia. And the reason for that is because, you know, 100, 150 years ago, the doctors working at the time noticed that there were these group of people that developed problems in their thinking and their memory in their teens and 20s, which is when schizophrenia typically hits. And they noticed that this was a lot like the dementia that they saw in older people, typically in their 60s and 70s. But there is a key difference that we've learned since then. And one key difference is that in Alzheimer's dementia, for example, you get loss of neurons. So the nerve cells are dying. But you don't seem to get that with schizophrenia, which is actually good news for our patients. The nerve cells don't die, but what does seem to happen is that the connections between the nerve cells, either there aren't as many made or they get pruned excessively. We all need the connections between our nerve cells to undergo some kind of pruning or refinement to make our brains, to ensure that our brains remain efficient. So
this is a natural process.
It's a natural process that's going on all the time, but particularly in our teens and early 20s, when our brains are developing very rapidly towards adulthood. And you need this sort of refinement of connections, because we develop many more connections between nerve cells than we need. And our brain needs to cut out the ones that are not used and not needed, and so that you can focus resources on those that are really needed. But if that goes wrong and you start cutting out useful connections, then you can see how that might mean that the brain actually starts misfiring, not working as efficiently, and that could lead to other problems.
But is there any reason why this goes wrong in these patients? Are there risk factors that make these people more susceptible for this to happen? Or, genetic factors or even environmental factors?
Yes, well, another way in which research has really advanced understanding of schizophrenia in the last decade or so has been the genetics of the illness. And we know that schizophrenia, along with many other mental disorders, have high heritability. In the case of schizophrenia, it's about 80%. So it's a really large genetic contribution to the illness. And in the last few years, big studies around the world have identified that there are something like 200 different variants in DNA in our genes that are linked to an increased risk of schizophrenia. And many of these actually are involved in the synapse and in synaptic function. So what I think is going on is that these gene variants that put people at risk of schizophrenia mean that their synapses are more susceptible to this pruning and not functioning as well. And that is the first hit. And then I think the second hit is actually that there seems to be an overactivation of some immune cells in the brain that are involved in clearing synapses that aren't needed. And this leads to the excess pruning of synapses in late adolescence that we think underlies the development of the illness. So I think there's sort of two components to it, this genetic component and then this later immune-related component, which could also be partly triggered by stress, because we know that immune cells are activated by stress.
Yeah, another risk factor and something that we wanted to discuss in this episode is the use of drugs. So it's been for a long time a common argument against the legalization of cannabis, for example, has been the link to schizophrenia or delusion type symptoms. So could you tell us a little bit about this correlation between drug use and development of schizophrenia?
Yes, what's really interesting about this is that the drugs that increase your risk of developing schizophrenia, it turns out are by and large the drugs that act on the dopamine system. So the drugs like cannabis and also cocaine and amphetamines, speed, these sorts of things, these are the ones that if you take them and you're someone who perhaps has a vulnerability because of their genetics, or if you just take a huge, a lot of them, then these drugs increase your risk of schizophrenia. And they all work by acting on the dopamine system, boosting dopamine levels and leading to dopamine overactivity. So I think that is the common pathway to the psychosis that you see. So there's probably several different routes with genetics and the immune system and the pruning that might lead to dysregulation of the dopamine system. But there's also, if someone takes these sorts of drugs, then they might affect the dopamine system specifically, probably without causing the pruning but that's enough to cause the dopamine system to be dysregulated and for them to develop the delusions.
Yeah.
That's very interesting. Just to touch on that, I guess, for example, ketamine is an amphetamine and has been shown, obviously, a ketamine overdose is associated with psychosis. But because of its action on the dopamine system, ketamine in microdosing in small amounts has been used as an antidepressant. So what's happening there? Is it sort of a small activation compared to an overactivation of your dopamine pathway, whereas you could potentially prevent or treat some psychotic diseases through mild amphetamine use?
Yeah, so I think that has been a fascinating development in the last few years, that we've learned that people that use a lot of ketamine develop these psychotic symptoms. And we some of our experiments have shown that ketamine, if you take it repeatedly, it leads to the same sorts of dopamine changes that we see in patients with schizophrenia. But at the same time, other people have shown that very low doses of ketamine actually can be antidepressant. And I think that's because, of course, that it depends what ketamine is doing to the dopamine system. If you take large amounts regularly, then you get this dopamine dysregulation and the psychosis. But the small amounts that are used to treat severe depression, I think they may be acting on the dopamine system, but it's a much more moderate effect. And ketamine also acts on other systems in the brain as well. So it's also thought that it might be acting on some of these other systems to be antidepressant. In fact, there's a suggestion that ketamine can boost the formation of synapses, so these connections between brain cells. Mm-hmm. So I think that explains that difference between, you know, taking lots of it and at high doses versus when it's used by a doctor to help treat as an antidepressant, but at a very low dose.
That's fascinating. So there's a careful balance there.
Yes. And it does highlight, I think, a risk that there could be with people starting to use ketamine as an antidepressant, that if people aren't careful, they don't use it in a controlled way, and they take too much, you could increase the risk of developing psychosis.
Problems with taking your own therapy into your own hands.
Exactly.
Probably the dosage is very important. And so is it a sort of habituation-based mechanism then? Is there a careful balance on the dopamine levels in your brain and you sort of get used to a higher dopamine level? Is there an acclimatization to that? Is that how these symptoms manifest?
In terms of the ketamine, what we know with taking it at higher doses and repeatedly is that it leads to an increase in the proteins, the enzymes that synthesize dopamine and the capacity to make dopamine. So I think that's what's happening when you take lots of it. Now, we've not tested the effects of the small doses that are used as an antidepressant, but I would suspect that these would not have that effect on the enzymes that make dopamine. So that's why it doesn't cause it's an antidepressant and doesn't cause the psychosis.
Okay, shall we get back to the generalized population and how it must maybe at the risk of developing schizophrenia, and maybe move on to our segment, autoclave. In this segment, usually we bring some hot and pressing issues related to the topic to discussion. And one of the usual goals of this segment is to discuss conspiracy theories that are related to science and try to debunk them in a way. But today we thought we could use your knowledge and actually take a step back and discuss the psychology behind what actually leads someone to believe these kinds of theories, and how positive feedback from other people who believe the same may lead to a generalized paranoia. I mean, nowadays with issues surging about surveillance and mismanagement of people's data, some of these paranoid delusions may actually find more and more fundament in reality for what otherwise would be considered probably paranoid ideation. So the question is, where do you draw the line as a psychiatrist, and what do you think about conspiracy theories in general from a psychological perspective?
So I think in terms of conspiracy theories, of course, it's important for survival that we are aware and pay attention to things that are going on and think about possible negative consequences, and that might be thinking about plots against us. And so you can see that it's adaptive to think about this and to be aware of the possibility of conspiracies. Mm. And so a bit is going to be adaptive and be useful, especially in a, as a social animal that we are. But of course, where do you draw the line? Well, as a psychiatrist, I think that the fact things that I look for are where this takes over someone's thinking and actions and starts to have negative consequences for them, when it starts to affect their ability to work or have social relationships. You know, if something takes over your life to the extent that you're not able to concentrate on your work anymore, you spend your whole life trying to evade surveillance and
yeah.
avoid people, you avoid your friends because of it, you know, that's clearly having a really big impact on you. And of course, in my patients, it often goes to the extremes of them becoming convinced that something is terrible is going to happen to them. They become very scared. They can't leave the house because of it. They might even try and end their life because they're so worried and convinced that something terrible is going to happen that they would prefer to try and end their life than take the risk of this terrible thing happening. So clearly,
yeah.
when it's got to that extreme, it's really disabling for someone. But of course, you know, at the milder ends, yes, I mean, it could well be that this is adaptive and in certain circumstances it could help you. You know, an interesting study we did a few years ago was to look at the dopamine system in people who didn't have schizophrenia but had some of these strong beliefs and experiences around conspiracies, and also some people that had experienced voices as well. And what was interesting there was that what differentiated them from people with schizophrenia was the dopamine system. They didn't show the same dopamine overactivity that we saw in people with schizophrenia. So I think it's when the dopamine system becomes overactive and dysregulated, that then drives these beliefs and experiences to take over thinking and behavior, and that's when it starts to really impact on someone. But of course, lots of people have conspiracy theories and are able to function very well and get on with their lives and have you know, full fulfilled lives, and they don't need any help or treatment.
Yeah, but is there any evidence that these people with this, let's say, personality type would be more at risk of developing schizophrenia? Or do they have, I mean, for example, in that study that you mentioned, did you see any kind of dysfunction? Do you think that some of these people could be subclinical, let's say? They may have some dysfunction, but not really to a point where you would say, okay, you have this disease.
There is certainly some evidence that people that are prone to that sort of thinking, the conspiracy thing-like thinking, are at an increased risk of developing schizophrenia over the course of a lifetime. So, you know, it may well be that a little bit is adaptive, but if it goes too far, then it may start to shade into developing an illness. But I think what of course we need to understand is what makes the change, and why is it that they then go on to develop the illness. That's why our study looking at some of these people with these experiences was very interesting, because it showed that they could have that sort of thinking, but they didn't have the dopamine changes. And I think what happens is that for some people, maybe because they take drugs or maybe because of stress later on, that dopamine system then becomes dysregulated. And then that tendency to think in terms of conspiracies then starts to become, take over their thinking. And take over their behavior as well. And that, I think, is what tips them over the edge into developing an illness.
I was just wondering, I mean, if that percentage of the population is somehow at risk of developing schizophrenia, then this disease will become more and more common, because currently it isn't very common, right?
Well, it is pretty common. It affects 1 in 100 people. So if you think about your class at school when you were growing up, that means probably 1 or 2 people in your class have developed schizophrenia. We know that it affects people throughout the world. So across the world, about 60 million people experience schizophrenia in their lifetime. That's
a pretty high number.
pretty close to the population of the United Kingdom, and it's one of the top 10 causes of disability in adults in the world. And that's partly because it's an illness that affects people often for their whole lives, but also it begins early in when they're a teenager. But I think you also highlight this risk that we just don't know what would happen, but this risk at the moment that the social media seem to promote this sort of conspiracy theories, because what happens is that sometimes people get attracted to conspiracy theory websites, and then the social media feeds then start directing more feeds along the same lines to them, and they don't get alternative viewpoints or evidence. And so that means that reality checking is not so complete. And you can see that that may well mean that people start to become more and more cemented in a particular view.
Yeah.
Now, whether that leads to a higher prevalence of schizophrenia, we'll only see over the next, we'll have to wait for the next 5 or 10 years, because it's been too early, too soon to see that in with social media yet.
Hopefully the stress of this year and the COVID situation won't impact that either.
That's actually a very interesting point. I'd be interested to know how people are doing with, you know, people suffering with schizophrenia are doing during COVID. Do they tend to be less social, more introverted people? I wonder if lockdown for them was a good thing or a bad thing, and whether you have any insight for that.
Yes. I mean, again, it's early days for that, but it's overall, I think it's been a bad thing in many ways, because, of course, people with schizophrenia have difficulties with their social contact anyway, and then lockdown has removed what little social contact they might have that was being maintained. You know, the illness attacks that anyway, and then support groups they might have, they lost those. So they've become more socially isolated. And of course, it's made it harder to get healthcare and to see doctors and nurses. And then finally, you know, it's been an incredible stress for all of us. And that we know that people with schizophrenia are more vulnerable to stress as well. So I think, unfortunately, with COVID, we're going to get a second pandemic, which will be a mental health pandemic. And that'll be the effects of all this of COVID and isolation on our mental health. And that'll probably come as a wave in the next year or two, unfortunately, unless we can do something about it now.
Yeah, before we finish, do you have any advice on how to cope with stressful times like this one? It's not only COVID and all of this situation that's going on at the moment, but in general, how do you cope with stressful times in your life?
Well, that's a topic for another podcast in its right, of course. But I think, you know, the COVID situation highlights a number of things that are important for coping with stress. You know, social interaction, having friends and family that you can talk to about your worries is really important. And COVID has made that harder. But it's important to actually think, we've been told to socially distance all the time, but that's wrong. We shouldn't be socially distanced. It should be called physical distancing, because it's physical distance that we need to stop the spread of the virus. But we need social interaction to help us maintain good mental health during it. So I really think we should stop calling it social distancing and talk about physical distancing. That's number one. And then another key thing for stress and helping yourself with stress, of course, is to think about your physical health as well. And it's body and mind. And of course, exercise is very valuable there. And being able to do some regular exercise, even if it's just walk every day. But this sort of thing really, really is important.
Yeah.
So those I think, in brief, are really key to stress minimizing.
I think those are two very good messages to finish our podcast. Thank you very much for your time again. It was a pleasure to talk to you, and I think I've learned a lot, and hopefully people who are listening to this will learn a lot from this. So yeah, thank you again.
Thank you. That's a pleasure.
And now we move on to our publication of the month.
Extra, extra!
This month, Katie Stevens from Molecular Systems Research Group here at the LMS is going to tell us about her research paper on Eastern variants in archaea and the evolution of combinatorial chromatin complexity. Hi, Katie, again.
Hi.
Thanks for accepting our invite and congratulations again for your publication.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for talking to me.
Okay, so to give some context to this story, could you just briefly tell us why histones are important and how you got interested in studying archaea?
So histones are proteins which can bind to and wrap DNA. And so they have real importance in eukaryotes. So by eukaryotes, I mean cells with a nucleus, cells like human cells and plant cells, fungi, and they are really important in regulating transcription and in packaging your DNA into a cell.
Mm-hmm.
And the histones that I look at are in archaea. Archaea are a little bit different from eukaryotes. They tend to live in really extreme environments, but they also have these histone proteins. And they're slightly different from the ones in our cells, but they have a few similarities as well.
So could you just briefly mention some of the main findings of this paper?
So in our paper, we looked at diversification of histones. So what we were interested in is, are they all doing the same thing or are they all doing different things? And because archaea live in really weird environments, like really high salt or really, really high temperatures, it makes it quite difficult to study them where they live. So we use computational tools and we looked at how the structures might be different. So what these proteins look like and how they might bind and wrap DNA differently. And we found that some methanogenic archaea have specific histones which tend to sort of fall apart rather than stay together and form really stable structures with DNA. And we found that they're kind of widespread throughout quite a lot of different archaea. And we also showed that there's quite a lot of diversity, which wasn't really seen before.
Yeah, you also mentioned in the paper, this may be important to understand how eukaryotes kind of established this mechanism of chromatin organization coming from archaea. So could you explain a little bit how this may have happened and how impactful this is to understand how, even in eukaryotes, how chromatin organization works?
So histones in archaea were or are thought of as kind of ancestral-like eukaryotic histones. And by that, I mean, at some point in evolutionary history, a eukaryotic cell or a cell that was ancestral to a eukaryote had to acquire a histone. And all of those are present now in all eukaryotes, or almost all eukaryotes. And these archaeal histones are a lot simpler than eukaryotic histones. And so that's why people think these look a lot like the histones that we might have first seen in eukaryotic cells. And what we didn't know was whether in archaea or in a cell that's ancestral to eukaryotic cells, there might be the potential for diversification of chromatin structure. So whether you might be able to swap in different histones and change chromatin organization. And that's kind of where our paper sits within the evolutionary story.
Yeah. So do you have any ideas? I mean, I'm sure you have. what are your personal interests in terms of following up this research and understanding more about this topic?
I think we're kind of interested in seeing whether we can find any other examples of specific paralogs in archaea, so whether we can find histones with a kind of distinct function, because I think a lot of the diversity still remains to be explored. So I think that's probably what we're going to follow up on and maybe do some more molecular dynamics and that kind of thing.
Yeah, sounds very interesting. So perhaps you can come back for the next publication.
Fingers crossed.
Yes. So thank you very much, Katie, again. And again, congratulations for this paper.
Cheers. Thank you very much.
That's it for today. Thank you for listening. And follow us on your favorite podcast platform to get voices in your head telling you about science every month. See you next month.